Good morning, everyone. I'll open us in prayer and then pass the mic over to Barbara, our stained glass expert. God be with you. Let us pray. God of all creation, you offer us beautiful images all around us. Offer us an awareness of all that we can see that allows us a glimpse of you. Give us an appreciation of those artists who build icons of you and of your world so that we may have the smallest foretaste of your heavenly kingdom. We pray all this in God's holy name. Amen.
Okay, hope I can use this right. Glad to have you here. I've been working actually for a few years on the stained glass, and finally I've got a corrected booklet on it, and you know what? There might be enough for the everybody here to get one today, and I'm hoping more can get printed. I've been coming to St. Columbus since the 70s, and I'm an art historian. I was curator at the Capitol. I took care of painting sculptures and also a lot of stained glass in the Capitol. But, you know, there was never anything to tell us anything about the windows and what's in them and all those things. So let me see. Jamal, what do I got to do here? All right. Let's see. There. Okay. What events, what stories did they pick? Some of them we can tell. Who designed and made them? Who paid for them? Who did they honor? And when were they installed? And when you go in the church, that we see the beautiful light coming out of the stained glass. We walk in church and we're busy talking to people in the service and the music, and we don't pay a lot of attention to them, but they're just a treasure in this church. So we have these little plaques about whose memory they were donated in, even not in all the places. And I have many people to thank. A lot of people helped me with this, looking at the windows and helping with the research. And the big thing that happened was I found the archivist at the stained glass company that made them, that gave me copies of all the letters from the church to the company and all these details that we didn't have before. And also I got the windows photographed by professional architectural photographers, which has made a huge difference. They'd never been photographed before. So some of the windows, you know, we can all guess. Mary Joseph, the baby in the manger, everybody knows what that is. But, you know, there's other ones like this one on the right. What's happening? There's this guy on a bed and then somebody swooping in through a window. It turns out this is Joseph with the angel warning him before the flight into Egypt. And it's one of the ones that the minister at the time wanted added in the subjects. And it's not in the right order, actually, but it's there. And we can guess the crucifixion. Other ones, I can bet, even if I quiz some of the clergy in the church, the next one, Jesus is talking to somebody, but who is it, right? We don't have any way to know. One thing I learned, I'm not a medieval scholar. I'm American, and modern art is my subject, but I love color. That's why I love the windows so much. And every time Jesus is shown, he has something I didn't know is the typical thing. He has a trivalent halo with the three rays coming out, which is only used for the persons of the Holy Trinity. And he's always dressed in red and white. And the gesture that he's making is the blessing gesture, like the one the Pope uses today. And you'll see that in his hands in a lot of the windows. There's so many amazing details in these. And one thing, when I'm in church, like a couple weeks ago, the gospel was about the rich man and Lazarus. Here we have a window right in the church showing that. And here's the Lazarus there. He's got sores on his body. The dogs are licking his wounds. And there's the rich man grabbing all his wealth while other people are bringing more riches to him. He's the one that ignored Lazarus. So the way they told the stories in these little round circles in the glass is really amazing, all the details. So how did we end up with stained glass at St. Columbus? I think everybody knows we just had the anniversary of when the church was on this property, and then the 1904 we got the name St. Columba, one of the saints of the British Isles, and a parish hall and this more expanded church, a little wooden church. This is what was torn down to make this church. In 1924, St. Columbus became independent. Before that, it was a mission of St. Albans. And what was happening in the neighborhood, and Sandra Mills has told us so well about this, this whole history of racism in the neighborhood. Janney School had just been built in 1925, four white children only across the street. There was this big push to move all the black people out of Fort Reno, including the church that was affiliated with us, St. George's. And so part of the story on this fancy, beautiful church had to do with gentrifying the whole neighborhood, making it more fancy. As soon as they became an independent church, they started thinking about, let's get a new church, a building. And so they set up a building committee. The rector was William Shearer, and the chairman was A.F.E. Horn, who was a big businessman. And then the big person in the story was William Tyler Page. He had been the choir director in the old church since 1907, and he was the first senior warden on the vestry, but his day job was he was clerk of the House of Representatives, and he wrote something called An American's Creed, based on the Apostles' Creed that he was famous for. And I noticed when I got the church records, he would a lot of times write on House of Representatives stationery, which I don't think was really legit. And then the architect they chose was Gilbert Lacoste Rodier, who was quite a prominent architect. But interestingly, he was specialized in Art Deco architecture. As far as I know, this might be the only church that he designed. And then the builder was George Fletcher. We know the Fletcher family being important in this church for many generations. And the stonemasons were Perna and Sons, who built a lot of buildings, had their own home in the neighborhood. They were kind of part of the neighborhood. And they donated some of the windows even. And so the architect came up with the final architectural drawings in April 1926. So the church is a traditional shape of a cross with the transept arms, and the windows are indicated on there. Underneath, the parish hall was underneath. And as we know, the cornerstone was laid on St. Columbus Day in 1926. So it's amazing how excited people were about this, how fast things happened. And then the architect found out about this stained glass company, and was a very prominent one, wrote a letter to him asking for estimates. And what's interesting, at the time they said, well, we could just have plain windows, it would be cheaper, but or we could have one with figures in them and stories, it'll be more expensive. And luckily they picked those. So they didn't just keep the simple ones. And then the stained glass company sent back their estimates. And the things were put out to the parishioners trying to encourage people to donate money for the windows. So of course they sent this out in the newsletter that the windows have been brought with great care, not only beautiful stained glass windows, but leading events in our Lord's life on earth, teaching value as well as beautifying God's house. And these were the prices: the rose window out in the narthex, the sanctuary window with Christ, the two transept windows, and the small ones, only 300 if you just did two, or 600 for the whole window, and the St. Columba window, huge St. Columba window, was the most expensive. But amazingly, the company never raised its prices. They stuck to the 1926 contract. And the people that ran the company, the Willard Stained Glass and Decorating Company, founded it in 1898. It was a husband and wife team. They were both very talented, trained artists, William Willett and Anna Lee Willett. And they had gotten this big commission because there was this competition for the stained glass windows in this cadet chapel at West Point. Ended up being 172 windows. And this was in 1915. They had beat out all these other companies, including the Tiffany Company, for these windows, and did this beautiful job. One window is like 100 feet tall. Just amazing work. So William Willett really got interested in medieval style stained glass because a lot of the churches were doing Tiffany style windows, like the one on the right, Tiffany style, or even the ones in the Wigan Chapel are kind of the older ones, which I think, I'm guessing, were moved from that old church here, but that's the Tiffany style. And so the medieval style that doing for Willett was based on Chartres Cathedral, the beautiful windows in Chartres Cathedral. And they picked up the idea of also doing these round medallions for the scenes and the beautiful colors. The blues are so important in our windows, like they are in Chartres, and very intense colors. And you can see the one of ours in the middle there. And they always said they made them out of imported antique glass. So what that was, it's glass that's not just flat sheets of glass, but it's thick, it's uneven. If you really start looking at the window, some of those pieces are really thick, and because of that, it makes the colors more intense, and the way they come through the windows more intense. I mean, they're just really amazing. And so our church came in, William Willett had died, and his wife and their son, actually young son, I think he was pulled out of college to help run the company, because you really couldn't have a woman at that point running the company. So he was doing all the correspondence, and he really got into it, and he started doing the iconography, almost all the letters with him, between him, the church and the company, or signed by him. He was very active in it. But I think that his mother, who was the artist, really probably designed our windows in the 20s. She was a really good artist. I looked up some of her records, and she said on things that she gave to the Library of Congress that she designed and executed a lot of the windows, some together, some by him, but she was doing a lot of the son. And so then she retired in 1934, and then her son took over, and so basically, the rest of the windows were under him, and the company moved with another big company. But now, just recently, this last year, has returned to the name of the Willett Stained Glass Studios, and they're still making stained glass windows. But the credit for our windows was A.L. Willett and Henry Lee Willett. You notice they didn't use her female name in there. I thought that I noticed that. You can see a big feminist interested in women artists. But there were other artists in the company that would have worked on our windows. One was George Gugert, and he had started working with Willett in 1912 to the end of his life, 1958, so he undoubtedly worked on some of ours. He was co-director with Willett on some of the letterheads. You can see him working in his studio, and they would start with a small version, a small sketch or design, probably first pencil sketches, and then work it out, and then make it full scale. And then there was another woman, very, very active in the Willett Company, Marguerite Godin. And you can see here, she's got the full-size cartoon for the window, where they worked out everything, where the leading was going to go, all the details, everything they were going to use to make the final window. And she designed for Willett for 60 years. She was director and, you know, very important in the company. And just for local things, she did some of the windows at the National Cathedral. And in 1967, she designed all the stained glass at the National Presbyterian Church, if you've ever been there. I mean, she's really amazing, and you can't find much about her. So she was a wonderful artist. The company in the archives, what they could find for me was photographs of these cartoons that they had made for the window. So they kept an archives, and they kept some of those. Unfortunately, not all of them. I'd love to have them for every single one of our windows. But you can see the Christ in glory over the altar, the Annunciation, and the Nativity, and the wise men are some of the ones that they had. And only one color one, because then they would have to plan the colors. And this one color one they have, you can see, is for the St. Columba window. But each one of these scenes has so many different colors of glass in it. It's just really remarkable. And the idea of how they got the designs for the subjects, you know, they based it on traditional Renaissance paintings. Like in the paintings, almost always the angels on the left and Mary's on the right and the Annunciation. So they took these ideas from traditional art. One of the tricky ones in art was showing the resurrection. It's kind of hard to show that, but so the way in the Renaissance they would do it, they would have Christ standing in the empty tomb with the guards asleep and this red and white flag, and that's what's in our windows. Now, all the passion scenes are up where we don't all get to see them anymore, but originally that's what you would have been looking at them when you took communion, when the altar, you know, the altar was further back. So again, I was saying, if you look, I started looking in some of these scenes, and you could count at least 12 different colors of glass, very subtle, amazing collection that they had of glass. And Henry Lee Willett would talk about, he said, oh, I just love going and picking the colors for the stained glass. It's better than playing golf. You know, it's fun for him. But so there's a lot of other people there behind the scenes that were working on these. They had a crew of a whole company. You would have to find all the colors of glass, get them cut to the right shape exactly to fit that cartoon, and then they used something called came, C-A-M-E, which was like a little sort of U-shaped leading where you could put the edges of the stained glass in, fit those all together, and then some of them had to be painted. And this is where the artists came in. It's beautiful details in our windows with tiny brushes, different kind of brushes. Sometimes they did like on the faces, more of a watered kind of effect, and that was why they started calling the windows stained glass, because they stained some of the areas. But amazing, amazing details. And they painted with a mixture of powder glass and metallic things. And then each piece of that stained glass had to be fired at a high temperature to make it permanent. So, I mean, a huge amount of craftsmanship and tiny little details that you really have to stop and look, like this one of Jesus in the bottom, the Jesus and the centurion. He's pointing to his sick servant off in the way off in the distance. So they're tiny, tiny. So then Henry Lee Willett, he just came up with an idea. He gave the church 52 possible scenes for the windows, and with the minister and people picked 40 for the ones for the windows, and the minister had changed a couple. And then he lined it up logically for the church. So the passion ones are around up in the, what would be the, it's our north, but in the liturgical in the east, the end of the church, and then it's the life of Christ starting with the Annunciation, and then going back down here with various parts of his life, and then in the transepts, in the arms, he was going to have miracles on this side and Proverbs on that. So it was all very logically worked out. So when I started working on this, some of the order of some of the windows wasn't right. I finally figured out what happened, but it took me, I just recently, I really figured it out. So when the church was expanded, the windows on that wall were put into the doors, as we know. And so there were lists of the windows printed in 27, 57, and 60 is all we have in our church archives. But they haven't been available all this time for people. So the prominent one, the first one that was put in, they actually unveiled it and had a service on Christmas Eve, 1926. I mean, they were really getting this church done, this beautiful stained glass window, which we look at every day in church, and I had never realized what was going on with it. This is the end of the world. It's based on the apocalypse. Jesus is up there, swirling up in space with the sun and moon around him, all swirling around. This is the end of the world. It's from Revelation. And so at the top, there's Alpha and Omega, and on his book that he's holding and on his vestments, A-O, I am the beginning and the end. And so that's what this is. This is the end of the whole story when with Revelations, which I never realized. And they did little interesting things. You cannot see these from the church. That's why getting these high detailed photographs made me see so much. Because in this blue star sky all around him, there's patterns of shamrocks, three with three leaves, which are considered the symbol of the Trinity. But you really can't see them from the floor. And under his feet, there's like a cushion that's supposed to represent the world. And around him are the four evangelists, the symbols of the four evangelists, Matthew, the angel, Mark, the lion, Luke, the ox, and John, the eagle. But again, it's hard to see those when we're sitting in church. So then there's two other figures next to them. And the one on the left is Melchizedek. and he's from the Old Testament. And you can see with the detail what he's holding. Obviously, as the forerunner of the bread and the wine, the communion, he was considered the king of Salem, a priest forever. So that's sort of Jesus's priestly role. And then on the other side is St. Michael. He's in Revelation also, and he has just killed this little tiny little dragon that's supposed to represent evil with a flame still coming out of its mouth with his sword. But sort of he's good over evil there. And so that's why they're there. And so I've created this booklet, 20-page booklet, and it has the biblical references in them. And then there's going to be more on those on the website because it takes a lot of space to put those. And so this is what the church looked like when it was open. And look at all those aisle windows. They are just empty. They were just, I think, sort of opaque, yellowish glass there. And when the church opened, it was finished for Palm Sunday in 1927. And the clear story windows, the seven windows up here, were considered part of the construction. They were put in early, and they have the amazing symbols in them, which again is really fun to watch. Like, I love this cardinal on the nest, but each one has several interesting symbols in them. And then, so when the church opened, this is what was here, the rose window, the clear story, the sanctuary, and I forgot to say, when they unveiled it, William Tyler Page got a government searchlight outside so they could light it up for the midnight service on Christmas Eve. That must have been really exciting. And so just some of these seven of the aisle windows were in, kind of randomly what people wanted to donate. And as I mentioned, the one when they were put in the doors, this is something it took me a while to figure out. They were put in backwards. You're supposed to see them from the church, but they're put in so the fronts are on the common, but they're not lighted, so you really can't see them. And when I finally got the drawing from the stained glass company, it was very clear. This is how it should be. When I had them photographed, they photographed them from this side because, you know, we didn't realize that. But so I switched them I just flipped the photo for the book. Then in 1928, just the next year, these huge transept windows were installed. And now we can't see them very well because of our beautiful organ and the balcony. But when you can get around and kind of peek around and see all the symbols in those. Those are kind of dark or very kind of mysterious. And they talked about them being made of quarry glass, as with these little triangle things. So then, in 1929, William Tyler Page's wife died in March. In April, he wrote to the St. DeWillett and said, I've had the misfortune to lose my wife. He wanted to do something as a memorial, but he really thought the St. Columba window needed to go in, but he could not afford to pay the $3,500, which today would be about $65,000, if you just do inflation. So he said, unless some individual gives this window as a memorial, it'd be many years before we'd have it. And so the company agreed to let him pay $500, like periodically over years, to pay for it, which was just amazing. Now, this is April, and then he wanted the window ready for St. Columbus Day. Can you imagine? They really worked on it, and they got it ready in July, but I think they went next week, not quite St. Columbus Day, but it's amazing. And this is the only one where the memorial is part of the window. If you ever stop and look there, Mary Ann Page, his wife, when she died, and the prayer about her. But it's just such a glorious window. And the architect wrote that he thinks it's one of the most beautiful pieces of stained glass he'd ever seen, nothing like it in Washington. It's just really magnificent. So we have stories about St. Columba in it. Under his feet, there's one devil with the green wings pulling on his legs because he did something supposedly that people got was bad. He copied a manuscript without permission, wouldn't give it back, and here he is begging forgiveness for that. And I think the manuscript is up on the wall. And then there are the scenes from his life are him leaving Ireland when he went to Iona to Scotland with a little boat, him copying the Psalter, so well known for what he wrote and copied, his death in the chapel at Iona, and then the vision of King Oswald, who had a vision of St. Columba, and after he had the vision, he won his battle and became king. So that's why, for somehow reason, that's in there. So again, just beautiful. And in the booklet, there's one thing that Willett said, there's little symbols of the different monasteries where St. Columbus was. And I put that in the booklet. I didn't put it in the story, but you can look, they're so hard to see. So here it is. He funded that window in 1929, right before the crash. So people were not going to be funding very much then. This is a time when what happened after this, that Sandra has talked about in a book, how the money that was supposed to go to St. George's was taken here to pay the mortgage in 1936. Some kids or somebody, vandals, threw rocks and broke a lot of the glass, and the church really didn't have money to pay for it. It was a really difficult time. But there was one window donated in 1936, and by that time, there was a different minister, had to figure out who made it. And then in 42, the minister named Mingers, who was there a long time, came, and he got in touch with Willett and kept pushing the other windows. So 1943, we had another window. And then 1950, after the war, people started having more money, a bunch of them, 57. And then in 65, the window the Fletcher family donated, which was had the Proverbs. And finally, in 1966, the one that's now in the light box is the Miracles. These wonderful stories of the Miracles finally got donated. It got moved. If you look over at the shape there in this wall, you can see the donor plaques are still there. But now we can see them from the church, which is really good. But can you believe 40 years after they were designed until they all got in here? Nobody's ever realized how long it took. I mean, it happened with other places like the cathedral, but we didn't know that. So the thing that that I couldn't figure out, I finally figured out. The proverb windows here has on the lower right Jesus blessing the little children. Well, that's not a proverb. That's something that he did. And when the Fletcher family paid for the window, they paid for the Wise and Foolish versions, which is now down in the aisle window. And there was a letter where I think the Fletchers liked the story of the Jesus and the little children better, and they switched it, not really realizing what the whole plan was for the windows at the time, so many years later. So now we have the, I sit near the Wise and Foolish version, so I look at them a lot. So you have Jesus as the bridegroom coming in, the five women that, you know, filled their lamps, and then way off in the background, the other ones running around looking for oil, and they missed the boat there. But again, look at the wonderful details, and the faces are painted in different styles, I think, depending on which artist worked on them. And so this is the one, and I finally realized, too, that John Berger was helped with this. He noticed that two of the windows have dates on them, Willett Studios dates, and more of them may, but they're way high up and things. I haven't found them. And the one with the Wise and Foolish versions is dated 1965. So that's what happened, and the switch was made then. So, and then, as I said, the Miracles are wonderful. They are beautiful subjects. And I love the marriage of Cana and pouring the water, turning into the red wine, the draft of fishes. I mean, they're all such amazing stories that they fit into the little space. One I didn't know about was Christ raising the son of the widow of Nan. And I didn't know that story, but that was one of the first, one of his early miracles, so that's why it got put in. And so the subjects were listed, the biblical verses were listed in the printout in 1957. So I've checked a lot of those. Some of them are in more than one gospel. And like the Sermon on the Mount is kind of fun because that's the stories there are from three different gospels. The hiding your light under a bushel and the lost sheep, the shepherd carrying the lost sheep, and then the house built on stone rather than sand. So they really, again, put wonderful details and expressions on the faces, the gestures, the art of them, of the way they did it is just amazing. So then what I've worked on is the biblical things. There's not enough room in the little booklet to put them, but for the website, there's going to be a section that has these there, and I put the pictures bigger, so if you go, when they go up, you can go on the website and you can look at them more in more detail that way. I'm going fast because I know I don't have a lot of time. So we've got booklets. I printed one booklet and found some mistakes on it. So this is the corrected booklet, and we don't have I hope we have enough for people to share here and that we'll get more printed up. But the idea of these, and I want to put some out because you can walk around the church and use this and look at them. You don't maybe need it at home, but I think it'll really be helpful. And I've always thought about kids in the church and learning about the stories through the windows and everything, and I hope we can use them more now that we have these good photographs that can be used in a lot of different ways. Anybody have any questions? Yes. They said they imported it from Europe. Yes. Where did the stained glass come from? They still import from Europe, so I don't know exactly. So that's a good question. When you do research, you keep coming up with more questions all the time. So I'm writing up a bigger history of all this, of what I just summarized for the website. And hopefully what I'd like one day for us to have a book about the history of the church and the stained glass and other things in it that we can have. I hope to do something like that for the anniversary, but I hope someday we can do that. Any other questions? Yes. Yes, yes. Well, they painted all these details, the faces and all the drapery, little brushes. They used a kind of the paint was not really paint. It was powdered glass, like iron oxides mixed with something that make it liquid, and then they used tiny little brushes. And they put it on the piece of glass, and then they fired it in a kiln to make it permanent, so it can't be wiped off or anything. So they are there. You imagine how much time each window took. You know, so they are painted by hand by these artists, I think the ones that designed them, that were the great art, the good artists. Yes? Pardon? Well, somebody from the Willett Company came, and they sent somebody to do an inspection. So we have a report. They're mostly, I think, in pretty good condition. But there are some problems, and we don't want to have leaks around, and that's the worst thing. As long as things are maintained, they can last. They should last the life of the building, for sure. Somebody else? Anybody else?
Yeah, Barbara. Yes. First off, thank you so much for doing this incredible work on this project. You had pointed out in a number of instances some of the really small details that you can't necessarily see just when we're sitting in the nave. And I'm wondering, as you did this research, did you come away with a favorite scene or window or two? And then what's something you found that most surprised you when you were doing all the learning on this?
I think I've told you the big surprising things in my talk. You know, how long it took, 40 years that they didn't raise the price, all that time, who the artists were, nobody, you know, these are all things that I never knew. And I don't know, I can't pick one. I love them all. No, of course I love the St. Columbus. I'll say that if I have to pick one. That's our wonderful window. Anybody else? Yes.
Again, thank you very much, Barbara. I'm wondering, since you obtained all of these records from the company that made the windows, where are those records now located? Are they in what we sort of nominally call St. Columba's archives, or have you retained them, or where are they?
Okay, good question. The stained glass company had sent them to St. Columba's a long time ago, but I don't know what happened to those. So I need to get a way to get them in the archives. Sandra and I took care of the archives at the Capitol, and we need attention to our church archives because, you know, these are just really important and interesting history that this church has had. So I'll have to make sure I get my things into the archives.
Okay, but you personally have them at the moment?
I have them on my computer. I printed out some to work with. And the church archives mostly has the things that were printed out, handed out, some of the letters. But all the letters from the church went to the Willett, and they saved them remarkably. So I've got the digital files, and we need to figure out for the church archives, you know, paper paper versus digital or both for different files. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I've been in those archives a lot, and I've never seen any of this.
Right.
Nothing like
that. Right, no. Yeah.
Thanks.
So that's why I somebody had worked on stained glass at the Capitol because I had a fellowship program there, and I couldn't find her. And then one time I went on my computer, and I found she had emailed me. She had a painting by the artist I did my dissertation on. So I emailed her, I'm looking for this company. And she right away put me in touch with the company. And the archivist is so excited that somebody cares about it. And I sent him a set of the photographs, because most churches, like, we had never photographed these. So what I did at the Capitol, make sure the artist photographed. If a tree falls into a window, you don't have a photograph of it. What are you going to do? So, yeah. Yes.
Thank you for this work. It's just amazing. Years ago, I taught a Sunday school lesson here, I think for 4- and 5-year-olds, on temple worship. Mm-hmm. And we came into the church, and one of the aspects of the temple worship was the image of pomegranates. And we found one mm-hmm. up there. Mm-hmm. We found the kneeler that mm-hmm. had the pomegranates.
Wonderful.
And it just brought the kids, you know, into the church, like, with a real focus. So maybe some of this material, like word search, you know, picture searches and that kind of thing for children to really...
Yeah, that's one thing. I mean, I taught kids at one point in my life and doing a treasure hunt. Can you find these symbols, you know, for the kids? So, I mean, that's something we can work on, too.
Yeah.
I'd like to do that. Anyway, thank you all. I mean, I haven't volunteered a lot at St. Globe's, and I said, this is something I can do, my skills for the church, and I'm hoping, I'm glad you appreciate it. Thank you.